So we've done this long thing where we've calculated the let me write down what we had. We calculated the infrared divergent part that we got when we did loops of soft photons, and there was this nice factorization, and the answer was I can't remember if I was using the M. I think it was I was using M. So the thing involving the soft loops was approximately, this is the leading, the infrared divergent part, with some it was some factor lambda over lambda to the A over 2 times E to the I curly G over 2 times whatever the amplitude was without the soft photons, where lambda was the dividing energy between what we mean by soft and hard. And lambda was the IR cutoff. And capital A, we had this formula, which was 2 pi squared sum over the legs of A to N, A to M. Oops, I'm sorry, that wasn't there. That canceled out. Divided by, sorry, there was a 2 pi to the fourth here, so I guess that's altogether 8 pi squared. And we had a beta N M times the logarithm and curly G was 0 if A to N was not equal to A to M, but it was equal to 1 over 2 pi. What? Right. Okay. One over 4 pi. Log lambda over lambda. Sum over N M Q N Q M over beta N M. So we had this thing, and in particular, the thing we're going to be interested in is the rates. So we're going to be interested in M squared, and so we're interested in, if we call this whole thing curly F, then the absolute value of curly F squared, which is the thing that'll appear in the rate squared once we square everybody up, won't care about this phase, and it'll be just basically lambda over capital lambda to the A. And I've somehow got a sign funny there. I think I had capital lambda over little lambda here, the way I defined A. There's a sign running around here, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what I had yesterday was this, with this sign for A. But that's that factor 2 there, probably. Oh, so you're saying the definition of A was a factor of 2. So let me actually use this definition of A, because otherwise I'm going to screw up my notes forever. And this is the one that's going to appear in the square, which is the thing that's important. G, you mean this doesn't depend on NM?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't understand the question yet. So the
G is just bottom term where you only take the tensor eta are the same.
Yeah, but it depends on nm here, right? This is, you're asking that, what does the sum mean, or are you asking?
I don't think g is ever zero. No, so.
G is
the sum of all those terms where the eta is the same.
You're disagreeing with this line.
I guess.
But this is the, you remember this, the story was we had j nm was equal to I nm. You know, if the eta's were different, and it was equal to I n m plus this I prime n m, if eta n was equal to eta m, and this was basically real and this was imaginary. So this statement here that zero, it's the imaginary part is zero, just comes from the statement that in this case there is no I prime. So it's only in the case when you had you know, something like this or something like this, that would be the thing that gave you a phase, but you never got a phase from something like that. But then when you did have a phase, you know, the I prime wasn't zero and it was just this.
But G is the sum of all these terms, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just, because G isn't, well, G doesn't depend on NNN.
You'd rather write me, I could write this thing. What's that?
It really should be like a sum over n and m of zero, right? Like you're just saying.
I was thinking sum over n and m where you're excluding terms.
Right. So just forget the first thing and put a little eta n.
You'd like me to put a little thing here which is zero when the eta's are equal or not equal.
It's fine.
Yeah. So you don't like the way I'm writing it. Yeah. Okay. So, so that means that this is this. Because, and the signs are important because this is the one that we evaluated in a specific case and we got A was positive, and that was the one for which this is diverging when little lambda equals zero. And the claim is that it's always positive, although I didn't prove that. I don't know if I know how to prove that, but you have to think about that. That'd be a good exercise. So now the promise thing was that the little lambdas are going to cancel when we sum over all the soft photon emissions. So that's the thing that we have to do now. So what we want to do is we want to calculate the process where, you know, we're looking at a bunch of external legs, and we're looking at photons coming off. You know, we also want to consider things where we got soft photon loops and photons coming off. And so, but we know how to include the soft photon loops because that's just a factor. So if we calculate, what we're interested in is calculating the differential rate. So the rate for, you know, alpha goes to beta, plus a bunch of photons with energy E. So, excuse me. So, you know, so there's let's say, see, we get the sum over the number of photons coming off, so we'll have a sum, you know, N equals zero to infinity. Photons are identical, so there's always a 1 over n factorial going to be in front of everything. We're not going to follow the polarizations of the photons, so they all have some momentum, k, and let's say their polarization we'll call zeta, so we'll have k1, zeta1, k2, zeta2, k3, zeta3. So we have to sum over all these polarizations, zeta1, zeta n, equal to plus or minus 1. Have to integrate over all our momenta, so we'll have d3 k1 over 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. So let's kind of call that the absolute value of k1. And then we have some matrix element. I'm leaving a space there. And the matrix element will be for the process that we had before we started sticking all these photons on. So if we're including the soft photon on the various legs that where we actually got loops, then that's that expression up here. So that'll be what we called m twiddle alpha goes to beta squared. Except that we've added these factors of, you know, this is what I guess called m twiddle mu 1 mu n alpha goes to beta. So if we didn't have the these emission points, this would have been literally what we have up here. And these emission points we've calculated already. You know, we know what these m's are as a function of the mu's, which I'll write down in a second. But it's contracted with polarization vectors for each of these photons. So we'll have k1, theta1. Squared. And we want the energy of these photons to add up to E. So we'll have some step function here which says E minus sum I equals 1 to N of KI. And because of that step function, you know, this integral, we're expecting it to diverge at the lower limit, at, so we're cutting it off with lambda. And we may as well cut off the upper limit at E because this step function is going to do that for us anyway. You know, we're never going to go fast. If all the energy had been in one of these things, we would have gone from lambda to E, and otherwise we never get that far. So there's putting E rather than infinity is not doesn't change anything because of the step function. All right. So this is the thing we have to evaluate. So, so we just need to put in what this is. So this factor here, remember, was that's going to be m twiddle alpha to beta. And then there was a factorization. There's a whole bunch of things that came for every external line here. We had a factor coming from essentially expanding that on-shell propagator out. So that's the each time we did that, we got a factor of eta. What do we call this? You know, I think I'm gonna have to sum now. So now, just like we had before, we're going to have to sum over which line we're talking about. So let me not. I'll have to do this as a. Let me not just do this as a something below here. I'll just redo the whole line there. So what I want to write is the absolute value of m I should write that as before I do the square, let me just write this. This is the thing we knew was equal to m alpha goes to beta times these factors summed over all the external lines. So we have sum of n1 to nn of eta n1 qn1 p mu 1 n1 divided by the denominator, which was pn1 dot k1 minus I eta n1 epsilon. And we have a factor for every line we've attached a photon to. So we'll have eta nn qnn pnn mu n divided by pnn dot kn minus I eta nn epsilon. Now the I epsilon it doesn't really matter for this particular application because, you know, for real, this is a momentum of an external line and this is a momentum of an external line. So we know that if we were in the rest frame of the electron, say that's what P is, that P n dot k is going to be in the rest frame of the electron. That's just going to be minus the energy of the electron times, you know, the absolute value of k. But that shows you that this is strictly less than zero. And so because it never goes through zero, you never have to care about these I epsilons, which are telling you how to negotiate the pole at zero. So as far as we're concerned, we can just ignore these for the for this part of the calculation. They were relevant when we're doing the loops, but it's not really playing a role in this radiation rate calculation. Yeah. Right. And for QED, that's sufficient.
Okay, right. And the other thing is that we're looking at the unpolarized rate.
Right. Because the idea is that you're not seeing these. These photons are so soft that you're not seeing them.
Right. And I was expecting that you're going to sort of sum over initial states, average over final states. So why isn't there like a 2DN factor?
That would be anything you're doing with the initial states and final states for the original hard particles is already buried in whatever the rate was that you're going to. So what I'm going to, in the end of the day, do is write this as being proportional to the rate for the hard process, and that'll have all the sum of the averages over initial states and sums of the final states that you were going to do. So I could put that in here. I mean,
it's in M, though, I guess.
Well, it's, strictly speaking, it's not, because M is the amplitude, the way I've been talking about it. So you could say, you know, put in here.
We have a sum over the
sum over Matt's stuff here. Initial, final, kinematics for, you know, alpha goes to beta. So that's implicitly there, yeah. I should have written it.
But you'd already written the sum over the polarizations for your emitted photons.
Because those are the soft things, right? So the alpha and beta process was some hard process where there was nothing soft.
Right.
So that'll have some, potentially have some initial average and final sum over states. You decide whatever you want to do. That's this.
Yeah.
And then now we've added these soft photons, so we have to sum over them explicitly.
Right. But don't you want to average over the final state? Not sum over
No, you always average the initial state, and you always sum the final states, because the average is coming in because you've got some density matrix saying you don't know how you started.
Right. Sorry.
Okay. So what do you want me to skip here? So you stick this into this, you get, you know, twice as many, because it's a square, we're going to get this thing squared. So we're going to get a sum over the ends, and we'll have another sum for the complex conjugate. They're all these p's are contracted with the polarization vectors. And we'll get, in the complex conjugate, we'll get the complex conjugate of the polarization vectors. And what we're going to use is that the sum over the polarizations of any one polarization vector, you know, say k zeta, eta star nu k zeta. This is the thing that's appeared in the propagator for the photon before. There's a piece which is basically eta mu nu. Then there's a piece which is proportional to the k's. You know, there's an alpha mu k nu plus alpha nu k mu. And then actually there was, strictly speaking, a piece involving, you know, the Coulomb interaction, which then canceled off something else in the non-covariant time ordering, which we don't have to keep track of because of the cancellation. And so it's the usual story that this thing is never contributing because it's always contracting into something which is conserved. So we checked that when we had this M and we contracted it with K, we got something proportional to the sum of the charges, which is vanishing because of charge conservation. So we don't really need to follow this either. So effectively, we can replace the sum over the polarizations with the metric. So we're going to end up having all these factors here that were initially contracted with polarizations are going to now become contracted with each other because of this polarization sum. So I won't do that. I won't write the intermediate step down, but let me write down what you get once you've done that. So we have that the rate we're talking about, alpha goes to beta, as a function of energy, I guess. So. Is the rate that you would have had for the hard process. And I should put here the twiddle here, because this is the thing including this factor, this factor of F squared. So this is code for F squared, the hard rate for alpha goes to beta. Then times all these things to do with the explicit final photon. So we have the sum, n equals 0 to infinity, 1 over n factorial. We have almost something which is simple. We have a product of a bunch of these, D3 K1s over 2 pi cubed, twice the... We have the step function. And then we have, once we've done this contraction, we have all these factors of product of, say, S equals 1 to N of the sum over N and M of A to N, A to M, QN, QM, PN dot PM, divided by PN dot K, PM dot K. All right, so what you'd love to do is, you know, this, you got a product of things that all look the same. So you'd like to write this as being something to the nth power. You've got an integral which is all the same too. The thing that would distinguish these k's, I should have written the k's here probably. This is k sub s. Did I get that right? Yes. The only thing that distinguishes the terms of the sum are the k's, which we're then integrating anyway. So if you didn't have the step function, this would be the nth power of the integral decay of this thing. And then we'd have an exponential, right? Because we'd have something to the nth power, an n factorial, and sum over n. So the only thing that screws it up is this step function. So we need a trick to write the step function in a way that will allow this thing to be written as an exponential. So here's the trick. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the fact that I'm going to use this integral I'm just going to quote, because before the lecture I didn't have time to figure out why it's true. Because that allows you to write the step function in an interesting way. So you can write theta of x minus a, in that case, as the integral from minus infinity to infinity of sine x sigma divided by pi sigma d sigma. Oh, sorry, missed a factor. E to the I a sigma d sigma. So let me kind of tell you why this is a step function. You know, this is a real thing, because if we take the complex conjugate, that just changes sigma to minus sigma, but this is even under sigma goes to minus sigma. So the way to evaluate this is just to take this thing and write it as cosine plus I sine, and you can forget the I sine because that's integrating to zero. So the way to see why this is a step function is to just evaluate the integral. So you've got integral minus infinity to infinity of sine x sigma divided by pi sigma times cosine a sigma. D sigma is what this integral is equal to. And you can combine that into, you know, a multiple angle thing, right? So that's 1/2 integral minus infinity to infinity of sine x plus a sigma plus sine x minus a sigma divided by pi sigma d sigma. So far, so good. So these integrals basically have this form. But this form tells you that the integral of minus infinity to infinity of sine beta sigma over pi sigma, that's equal to basically the sine of beta. You know, if beta is 1, then I've just written this out after dividing by pi. If beta is minus 1, then sine minus sigma is minus sine sigma, so it's a sine. So it's nothing very deep here. This is just rewriting this. But if you apply that to here, you can see that what you have is this is going to be equal to 1/2. And it's going to depend on the sine of x plus a and x minus a. And so, so it'll be basically 1 plus 1 if x is bigger than a. And it'll be 1 minus 1 if x is less than a. And that'll be 0, and that'll be 2. And so you can see that this is giving you the step function you wanted to get. So that's the trick. Probably. That's probably a simple way to see it. So the nice thing about that is that so if we use that for this step function, so what we had is theta of e minus, sorry, we had e minus a sum of a bunch of things, right? We had sum of I is 1 to n of ki. We apply that, then we can write this as being the integral minus infinity d sigma of sine e sigma. So e is playing the role of x over pi sigma times e to the I sigma times the sum of, and the beautiful thing about that is that now all the things involving k, this is now a factor, just like all this is a factor. So that means that we can take everything involving k and write it as being the integral dk of e to the I sigma k times this thing, the sum, and we're just getting that over and over and over again. We're getting that for each, we're getting a product of that for each photon. But once we've done the k integral, k is gone. So we're getting each factor is the same thing. So this is something raised to the nth power. So that means that sum n equals 0 to, so let me just write the answer. So with that, we've got that gamma of alpha goes to beta and e is gamma twiddle alpha goes to beta times sum n equals 0 to infinity 1 over n factorial. We have this dangling integral here. So we have the integral sine e sigma divided by pi sigma. But then we've got something which is just a power. It's just the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed times twice the energy times e to the I sigma times the energy. And then we have this factor here, which is times sum over n and m of a to n, a to m, qn, qm, pn dot pm divided by pn dot k, pm dot k raised to the nth power. So if I pull this outside, then what I want to do is I want to write this as times the exponential of that thing in the bracket there. So let me see this, that's right. Yes. So all we need to do now is do this integral, and you recognize it's an integral what we know already. So let's, we don't have to actually work at it. So let's do the integral. We have integral from lambda to e, d3k of 2 pi cubed twice. Let me write k is just the modulus of k. So this is k squared dk times the angular integral. We have an e to the I sigma k. Then we have let me write the angular integral separately. Everything I've written so far just depends on the magnitude of k. And we have the integral d2 omega k of We've got the product of the En Em 1 over Vn dot k. This is the unit vector in the k direction, remember? Minus 1. And this is the thing which we've evaluated already. So this is the thing which is twice 2 pi over the absolute value of Pn dot Pm, which is another way of saying that's minus the absolute value of Pn dot Pn times 1 over beta Nm times the logarithm of 1 plus beta. And this we can write as the exponential complicates things, but you can kind of see that for small k, you know, we've got, there's 2 powers of k that I pulled out of here, so I should have had a k cubed here. Now, this, remember, it's the same story we had before. I'm pulling out a factor, the overall factor of k here, because the energy and the momentum are both proportional to k. I pull it out, and I get two factors of k from this sum. And then I pulled out the factors of the energies, and then the velocity was the momentum divided by the energy, and that's where these factors came from. So you see, this is the divergence. This is a dk over k once we cancel that against that. And so what I'll do is I want to isolate the divergence. So what I'll do is I'll add and subtract 1 from this integrand, and so we can write this as being, I'm just writing this factor here. We have the integral from lambda to e to k over k e to the I sigma k. I can write that as being, if this had been a 1, this would have just been log of e over lambda. But then it wasn't a 1, so I should do the rest of the integral. But this thing is something which is infrared convergent, whatever it is, because this thing goes like k for small k, and so the singular part of the integral is gone. So we've exposed so I can take, you know, lambda to 0 here. It doesn't really make a difference. The thing that's going to be singular as lambda goes to 0 is this explicit factor that's been isolated. So if we combine everything, here's what we have. We have gamma of alpha goes to beta, and E is it's gamma where alpha goes to beta. We had the factor of F squared, which we can write now explicitly. It's lambda over lambda to the A. Times now this whole thing appeared in an exponential over here. So in particular, if I focus on the divergent part of that thing, that integral had a factor which was log e over lambda with some coefficients, and that exponential is going to turn this into a power of e over lambda. It'd be e over lambda raised to something. So what is that thing? So let's write e over lambda raised to, let me write it as lambda over e raised to something. I'll call it b. I don't think I've used b for something yet. Let me call it a prime, because that's something which I know I haven't used. And then there's a function, you know, I'll call it little b. Depends on capital A and E over lambda. So little b is the integral minus infinity to infinity d sigma sine sigma E over pi sigma of the exponential of of a prime integral from lambda to e dx over x of e to the I x sigma minus 1. And a prime, a prime will be the coefficient of this logarithm, right? So we have, so the coefficient of the logarithm is going to be basically this fact. We have something multiplying the logarithm, and that's going to become the power. So we just have to follow what that was. So the power is going to be, it'll be minus So remember the pn.pm will pick off the, in my integral, I followed this and this, because that depended on k, but the p's, this pn.pm is just going along for the ride, and it's going to cancel that denominator over there. So these things will still be present. So I'll have something involving a sum. There'll be some numerical factor here, which I'll come back to. nm, a to n, a to m, qn, qm. We'll have the, the pn that pm went away, so but we'll have the beta nm, we'll have the log of 1 plus beta nm minus beta nm. And then we have over up front here, we have 2 times 2 pi cubed multiplied by 2 pi. So it's going to be 2 times 2 pi squared, which will be 1 over 8 pi squared. And what I had here was log of e over lambda, but what I wrote here was lambda over e, so there's an overall sign change which I need to make, just because of the way I wrote a prime, that to find a prime. So if I've done that right, that's what we had for a, right? That's, yes. And so what we have is this. And so you can see explicitly the factors of lambda cancel, and this has just become a factor of capital lambda over e. Yeah. So that's the statement. That's the Bloch-Nordsick statement that the infrared divergences have canceled. This remaining thing is infrared finite, so we can take lambda to zero if we like. So we don't have to emphasize the lambda dependence here, because it's non-singular. Just because it's the same factor. This factor was in front of this, and it's also in front of the other thing. But I should, you know, I should leave them both prime, and then it's really this thing that makes them the same. All right. So in my notes here, I kind of you might have worried that. So what? So it's fine. Things cancel. Is this factor an important factor? And the worry might be that, you know, basically. Maybe I should write that down. So I guess the first thing we notice is that the little lambdas cancel. So, you know, gamma alpha to beta e is IR finite. Then you have the, in order of magnitude, this A is it's proportional to the charge squared divided by factors like 8 pi squared. So that's of the order of alpha over 2 pi, right? So that's something like 10 to the minus 3 or something like that for electrodynamics. So you might have thought, well, so this factor is actually never very important because it's always going to be something raised to the almost zero power. So given this is lambda over e to the a ever not one in practice. And the reason that this is important is that it can be not one in practice because this is essentially a large logarithm. If you wrote this thing as e to the a log lambda over e, the issue you're asking is can lambda over e ever be of order 1 over a? So the claim is that since lambda over e to the a is the exponential of a log lambda over e, this differs from 1 when ln lambda over e is of the order of 10 to the 3 or so. But that can happen, right? Because it depends on what your experimental setup is. So lambda, you remember, defined what your hard process was. So let's say you're looking at something like, E plus E minus goes to Z, goes to fermion, fermion bar. Then the basic energy in this process, the root S would be something like the Z mass. So that could be something like so that's 90 GeV. And so your definition of what you mean by hard, the split between hard and soft has to be less than this. But so let's say you say that you're going to call things soft, everything is 100 times less than this. So let's say that we take lambda to be order 1 GeV. What E corresponds to is that's the things that the photons that you're not seeing. So that could depend on a lot of things. Sorry, I'm saying this wrong. Let me just make sure I don't say this wrong. So the thing I'm worried about now is does it make sense for lambda to be bigger than the electron mass? Because that was the thing that was... If lambda were bigger than electron mass, then the electrons would have been soft. So I think what I want to say here is that I want... Yeah, no, let me get... Yeah, what I want to say here, I think, is that this thing, if I defined a hard process to be anything at the electron mass or less, then I'm good, right? Because hard, for the purpose of infrared divergences, if I stop things at the electron mass, then the divergent part is coming from smaller scales than that. But on the other hand, the resolution, E is basically the resolution of the photons I'm going to see. So you could ask, what's the least energetic photon that a detector might see here? And that might be, in the MeV range or in the GeV range, but it's not going to be in fractions of the electron of the you know, like 500 kilovolt range. So let's say this is a GeV or so. Then in this particular example, then this ratio, you know, E over lambda would have been something like 10 to the 4 or something like that, right? Maybe, actually, it's maybe 2 times 10 to the 3. So its logarithm is going to be, you know, of order 3. So this logarithm is not going to be enormous. But you can actually, this I went down this example without thinking it through. I should have thought of a better example, but there certainly you can get examples where this logarithm is large. The essential point is that these lambdas, lambda and E, are not tied to each other. One's the energy resolution, one's how you're defining soft versus hard. And for any particular application, they could be anything. And there's nothing that forces them to be order one. Because it's logarithmic, you can have a separation of scales like this, which is for which, you know, the difference between this and 1 plus A log of E over lambda, or lambda over E, trading this for this would not be so important in a case like this, where this logarithm is not big enough to counteract the fact that A is small. But you can have examples where this is order 1, in which case this resummation would have been important. The difference between this and this would have been important, and that factor can change things. And the reason I'm thinking of this is that I know that in practice, when you actually calculate the rate for E plus E minus, it's not a negligible rate. And so I'm screwing up here my identification of what these scales are. So let me think about that more and come back to you, because in practice, when you looked at resonance production of particles at LEP, your intuition is that loops are all 10 to the minus 3 in size, because that's basically how big this is. But the specific things that are the largest loops tend to be the ones where you've got this times some large logarithm. And this is one of the sources of large logarithms. So initial state radiation was an important correction when they were looking at LEP. And I'll just need to come back to you about what the relevant scales would have been in that case. There's a classic book you can read about this, which is where I'm going to go to read about it. So that's the Bloch-Nortzsch story anyway. So the bottom line is that for the photons, summing over final state photon emission, the first statement was that when you had soft photons connecting, the dangerous things was when they connected external lines. If you defined your hard process and you started connecting soft photons to things, the dangerous things in the infrared were ones where the soft photons were connecting external lines. Loops had the factor that had the property that the infrared divergent part factorized out front of the whole amplitude. And the emission process for soft photons also had the property that it was infrared divergent, where the divergent part factorized out front of the whole rate. And when you combine them, the infrared divergence is canceled between the two. Which is to say that the question that you asked, if alpha and or if the final state beta had a specific number of photons in it, that was the reason you were punished for that by having a infrared divergent answer was that if you can't ever really precisely say how many photons you had. All you really know is you had some number of hard photons and possibly some uncountable number of soft photons that you didn't have the resolution to detect. So when you ask the physical question, what's the rate for producing this number of hard electrons and photons plus some undetermined number of photons, then you got a sensible infrared finite answer. And that's the real lesson of infrared divergences, is that normally if you get one, then you've asked an unphysical question and the theory is punishing you for it. And as soon as you ask any unphysical question, quantum field theory will beat you over the head with a divergence of some sort. Last thought was that even this would have gone bad if the electrons had been massless, because in the limit that beta goes to 1, this is blowing up. That's the sign that if you had massless charged things, like gluons or something, things that are massless and in a non-derivative way are emitting other massless things, the infrared divergences are worse. And in that case, it's not sufficient to sum over the final state particles. You have to also sum over the initial state particles. And that's what the KLN theorem establishes for you. Anyway, so enough about that, unless there's questions. OK. So then I'd like to switch to a new topic. So the new topic is, we'll start it today and then probably finish it Tuesday. I want to go back to the renormalization group, because we talked about the renormalization group a little bit at the very beginning when we were normalizing things. But it makes more sense to talk about it now that you've talked about infrared divergences. So. And so here I'm following there's a Gilman and Lowe were the first ones. Gilman. That's PRL 95, 1954, 1300. But then there's a Coleman Erici lectures from the 70s sometime. And there's a book with Coleman's lectures in it, which I forgot what it's called, and I think it's in there. And then there's a Weinberg also wrote a contribution to I think it was a Festschrift for Lowe. And I think it's called something like Why Renormalization is a Good Thing. So now that you see the infrared divergences, you can kind of see there's a better way to see why the renormalization group plays an important role in particle physics or in field theory. So naively, what you'd like to say, you know, you're interested in things like we compute things like calculate. The cross sections as functions of energy, and they depend on say the masses of the particles involved, and they might depend on a whole bunch of dimensionless variables. You know, that could be angles and other dimensionless things. Shun. And you're often interested in the limit of what happens when the energy is large compared to the masses. So what we'll do is we'll ask, E is much bigger than the mass. So if this is an electron scattering, maybe you're doing it at LEP or something, and so the energies are huge compared to the mass of the electron. Now, normally what you just use is dimensional analysis, right? You would have said that this thing has dimensions of energy to the minus 2, so it has the property that, you know, it's a homogeneous function of degree 2. If I multiply everything that has dimensions of energy by a factor, then I'm going to get something which is my previous answer divided by that factor squared, because this just says that's like changing units, right? If I change from EV to ergs or something, that tells you how things scale. It just says that E has dimensions of sigma goes like 1 over energy squared dimensionally. So what you're tempted to say is that I could write sigma of E mass and X as being, I could use this property to scale E out. I could write this as being some function, you know, which is basically of, if I take lambda to be 1 over E, so I'm going to write this in a very formal way. You're tempted to say that if the energy is really large compared to M, this should be approximately equal to, you know, if I Taylor expand this answer in powers of M over E, that's a small number by assumption. And so this should be basically sigma, you know, 1, 0, x over e squared plus powers of m over e. That's kind of what you would expect on dimensional grounds normally. And it's not true in field theory. And the reason it's not true is these infrared divergences. The assumption you're making when you do this is that the limit where m and over e goes to zero, the answer is analytic. And we've just seen that it's full of logarithms of m over e. And so this kind of an argument is going to be wrong in detail because it's going to miss all these logarithms of m over e, which could be actually large if m is really, really small compared to e. And so the point of the renormalization group is to improve this argument to include those logarithms so that you can say something about the analog of this, but including the fact that specific things are making your answers singular as m goes to e. So this, I should have said, is naively is not true in quantum field theory because of things like log over m over e factors are singular. So the renormalization group is trying to follow the singular parts so that you can improve this argument in a systematic way. So you need to know where the singularities come from, and that's what we just talked about. So these singularities, singular behavior, as m over e goes to zero, that's an infrared divergence. If m is zero and you're getting a singularity, you're getting something infinite, and then that's, in the massless theory, that's an infrared divergence. So the looking for things that are not analytic in this limit is related to the infrared divergences, because that's the kind of thing that's making things blow up and become singular there. So basically it has two origins. So one of them is what we just saw. So there's the IR divergences whenever soft massless particles connect to on-shell external lines. Say hard on-shell external lines. And that was the whole story we just went through. And another source we also hit in passing, and it's in the assignment too. You know, when we calculated the vacuum polarization for photons, we weren't doing an S matrix calculation, right? When we calculated pi mu nu of Q squared, let me remind you what that answer was. I've forgotten now. So we had remember this was we found this was q squared eta mu nu minus q mu q nu times pi finite of q squared, and then pi finite was equal to 2 e squared over 2 pi cubed squared, sorry. Integral 0 to 1 dx of x, 1 minus x, log of 1 plus q squared x, 1 minus x, over m squared. So in particular, if we had taken m squared to 0 in this, we get a logarithmic divergence, right? Because this thing is going to infinity. So this was not an S matrix element. It wasn't. We didn't have our on-shell particles explicitly in this calculation. But the reason that we got something, so you might ask, so why is it true that that's diverging in the as the mass goes to zero, after we've done a song and dance about infrared divergences? What's happening is we got this divergence because we demanded that pi or normalized pi vanish at zero. And so if we just took the original graph that we did, you know, the thing that was, if we just took, the original thing we evaluated, right, was something like this. And so it had something like, we had Q coming in, and say this is P, and this is P minus Q. So we had something like integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. Then we had basically various factors, right? We had something like trace of gamma mu. I won't follow all the factors, but we had, say, gamma mu minus I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared, gamma nu, and minus I p slash minus q slash plus m over minus q squared plus m squared, something like that. And if you ask about, you know, is this diverging in the infrared, it says p goes to zero, it's not, right? Because if p goes to zero, this is finite, and this is finite, and so then it's only after we subtract off the, well, there's two things that happen. We have to first, we know, you know, on general grounds that we get the an overall factor of q squared comes from gauge invariance. So there'll be a factor of q squared that comes out front when we actually evaluate this thing in a gauge invariant way. And that'll give us pi, you know, the expression for pi that we had before we imposed that it was vanishing at zero would have also been infrared finite. But then when we subtract the value of pi at zero, that's where we get an infrared divergent answer, because things like, you know, if the mass is small, things like things that were finite when p was vanishing, if you expand them for small q, right, that's going to be 1 over p squared plus, well, so it's 1 over p squared minus 2 p dot q plus q squared. So that's basically 1 over p squared, 1 plus 2 p dot q over p squared. And the further you go down the series in powers of q, the more p's you have in the denominator and the more infrared divergent your answer gets. So if you subtract off the q equals zero piece, you get something which is more infrared divergent than what you started off with. And that's why this is diverging. And that's also why the self-energy in the assignment is diverging. It's because there we also made the assumption that the self-energy for the fermions vanished when it was evaluated on shell. So you can get divergences. And so the common message for both this example and the self-energy example I gave a couple days ago is that we demanded that these things, this vanishes at not at a random place, it vanishes at zero. And q squared equals zero is the on-shell thing for the photon, because we were trying to get the residue of the propagator to be one. For the electron, the condition that the self-energy vanished at p slash was equal to im, that was the on-shell condition for the electron. So we were demanding an on-shell, we were demanding a renormalization condition which was defined when the particle was on the mass shell. And so by going to the mass shell, we're reintroducing these infrared divergences. Renormalization. So, for example, q squared equals zero for pi mu nu. So the point of the exercise is that we can avoid both those problems, just by choosing what we calculate, right? So if we want to make an argument like the one over here, a dimensional argument with statements about Taylor series and stuff like that, then those arguments will work best if we don't talk about S matrix elements. We talk about, say, Green's functions or things where things are not on shell. Then we won't have to worry about this kind of source of infrared divergences. And we should also choose renormalization conditions which are not defined on the particle mass shell. If we do both those things, then we have a chance of being able to follow in an argument along those lines how things will behave at large energies in a general way. So in order to avoid these, so what we'll do is we'll calculate off-shell correlation functions. Not scattering amplitudes. Because if we know how they depend at large energies, then we could probably figure out how the scattering amplitudes might depend on things. And what we'll do is we'll renormalize in a way not dependent on the particle mass shells. All right, so let's say we've done that. So I wanted to give you an example here. You know, for example, I guess the thing on is, it may not be clear what I mean by this, but what you could do is if you have a coupling, G, say like the electromagnetic coupling, what you can do is you can define your renormalized coupling in a way which is not the, the three-point function evaluated at the mass shell. You can define it to be the three-point function evaluated at some random point in field space. Or where the momentum transfer is some specific value, but one that which is not a mass shell value. So say EG, define G of mu by something like, say, at momentum transfer, Q squared not equal to zero. So in particular, say it's Q squared equals some value mu squared, which is we get to choose arbitrarily. So that means that our renormalized thing is going to depend on some scale, which is where we evaluated, we defined it. And we should just keep track of that scale. And that'll complicate this argument that that we wanted to make about dimensional analysis. So if we kind of repeat the argument, the dimensional analysis argument, actually, I probably want to leave that argument up there. So. So we've got some Green's function. It depends on, actually, I'm going to think of a matrix element. Depends on energy, it depends on masses, it depends on a bunch of dimensionless things. Depends on these renormalized couplings, which themselves depend on some scale mu. And so it will also explicitly depend on mu, in principle. And this thing has dimension of energy to the delta, let's say. So if we use the dimensional analysis argument, this would be, we scale out the factor of E, there's some power, and there'll be some function, you know, 1 m over E x g of mu and mu over E. Because these mu's are the mu's that are appearing explicitly in your answers, and these mu's are the ones that are implicitly defining what you meant by the coupling constant. So if you just on dimensional grounds, if you have explicit factors of anything that has dimensions that's in your answer, it has to be scaled when you scale. Right. You'll see, yeah. You'll see that this, you know, this when we solve for g of mu, because g is dimensionless, it's going to have another scale in it, like the QCD scale. And so if you had included that, it's going to fall under this. If you had scaled that as well, then you'd find everything was a function of the QCD scale divided by E, and everything I'm telling you is true. But I want to write it this way because I want to make a point. So the thing is that, so writing things this way, you know, we've chosen not to be at these two places. So that means that we're expecting that this thing is a nice, you know, should be smooth, non-singular. But the problem is that it doesn't mean that the answer is non-singular, because we do know that we know something about what this dependence is, and we know that that typically is singular. That you know, we've calculated how our normalized couplings depend on scales, and we found that it typically depended logarithmically on the scales involved. So this can be singular. Another way of saying that is that we don't know that this is non-singular, because this is something which wasn't in the argument before. So this can be singular. But the good news is that if you know how g depends on mu, you know how it's singular, because you know that mu is actually not in the answer. Mu is an arbitrary thing that you chose to define what g was. And so whatever the singularities are in this, they're compensating the singularities in this, because the whole thing really didn't depend on mu. Its singularity is controlled by g of mu. So if you chose, since mu is arbitrary, one way to get rid of the singularity is choose mu equals e. Then there's certainly things are not singular then. So to avoid a singularity at mu over e much less than 1, choose mu of the order of e, in which case then you have that gamma of e m x g mu mu. So I'm just rewriting this first line. So now any singularity is going to be explicitly a singularity in g of e, which you know once and for all if you know how g of e runs. So as for E much bigger than M, potential singular stuff is all in G of E. So there's a large logarithm in your problem. You can find it once and for all by seeing how your couplings run. And once you've established that, that's by choosing your couplings to be normalized at the energies at which you're doing, you know, you're probing in your correlation function, you can isolate the potential singularities in something that you establish once and for all, and you don't have to recalculate every time you think about things. So the upshot is that the running of the couplings, and here couplings, think broadly about couplings. Any coupling, any parameter in your Lagrangian. So you know, G is any parameter, any dimensionless parameter. Basically, it's any parameter because you can make them, all of them dimensionless. So for example, it could have been the electric charge in QED. It could have been the mass of the electron, the parameter, you know, the coefficient of psi bar psi. So you have m psi bar psi, call that m naught to distinguish it from the physical mass. And it could have been m naught over mu. That could have been g mass. And so for any parameter you have in the Lagrangian, you can define a dimensionless g, which is in this collectively in that, when I write g of e here, I mean collectively all those things. So if you know how they all run, that's telling you about how correlation functions are behaving in the large energy limit. And it's telling you in particular the thing you're getting wrong by assuming that things are analytic in the limit that the energies are large compared to mass. So that's probably a good place to stop. And so the goal of the renormalization group is first to see how these things run, but then secondly, something which we've already talked about is not only do these couplings tend to be, not only do you tend to get singularities from the couplings, you tend to get things tend to go, for every power of the coupling, you tend to get more singular behavior. So you get, so if you imagine calculating in perturbation theory, if you calculate functions as a function of g and other variables, you know, m, x, and stuff, if it comes to you as a series, say it's, you know, g squared times f naught, and this, supposing the logarithmic piece is a log e over m, say, if you go to higher orders, what typically happens is that you got, you know, more singular behavior. And so if there's a correlation between how singular things are and how many g's you have, you can worry that actually the expansion parameter you're working in, so does perturbation theory rely on g being small, or does it really rely on g squared log of e over m being small? And as you derive it in perturbation theory, it really derives on this being small. But the renormalization group allows you to infer a result which relies only on this, where you've essentially resummed all the things that are, if this is order one, you've included them all. You can calculate them all in a very efficient way. So the answer initially is, you know, if this is two and this is one, but the renormalization group allows answers to be inferred, for which one suffices. So we can pick it up there.